Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
We are back again from our sporadic sabbatical, and our guest today is Douglas Dauma, trail name Banzai, who is a graduate of the University of Michigan, Wake Forest University, and the Sangre de Cristo Seminary. He is a licensed minister in the Reformed Presbyterian Church, Hanover Presbytery, and as an independent scholar and historian, authored the book The Presbyterian Philosopher, the Authorized Biography of Gordon H. Clark. We will talk a bit about that book today, but we also want to discuss his other great work, the creation of a ministry called Sola Appalachian Christian Retreat. While this podcast tends to be centered around scholars of religion, I also love to interview practitioners, those folks that live out their faith in the trenches of day-to-day life, because they often have on-the-ground insights that many of us eggheads miss. The great thing about Doug, though, is that he is both a scholar and a practitioner. And if the name Dauma sounds familiar, I should note that we had Michael Dauma on a few months back talking about Dutch religious history. And it was right after we completed that interview that Michael said, "Hey, you got to talk to this other guy, Banzai." And I'm like, "Banzai?" And he says, "Yeah." And I said, "Okay." And so we are. Here we are today. We will link back to the other Dauma's interview on our website, plus Doug's book on Gordon Clark, as well as to this Christian retreat that we will be talking about today. So hike on over to our website and check out all of this great stuff. Doug, or Banzai, as I should say, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. Glad to be here. And I should point out, you didn't make the connection explicit, but Michael is my twin brother.
Twin brother. Oh my gosh, I thought there was going to be some time separating you, but you guys are thinking alike. So we're channeling both of you, I guess, which is pretty cool.
Maybe one more note, not to be too nitpicky here, but you will quickly learn if you come to this region that it, in fact, is the Appalachian Mountains rather than the Appalachian Mountains. And it's something I had to learn myself moving here from Michigan as a northerner. Now I have the correct pronunciation as spoken through this region.
Okay, so help me out with guy. I pronounce it Appalachian. I grew up in Wisconsin, so I pronounce all the words like this. I've tried to lose that accent, but Appalachia? So, no.
Yeah, you want to say Appalachian.
A lap app.
If you look at the origin as far as based on the Apalachee Indian tribe, which I believe was in northern panhandle of Florida, if you think of the Apalachee Indians, it might help you think of the Appalachian Mountains.
Okay, well, I have about 50-plus odd years of pronouncing it the wrong way, so if I do mispronounce it throughout the interview, I just ask forgiveness of everybody, and you can correct me. Our primary goal today is to learn about this very interesting and unique missionary organization that you've called SOLA, but before we dive into that, I want to ask you about your work on Gordon Clark. As noted, your book is entitled The Presbyterian Philosopher, The Authorized Biography of Gordon H. Clark. What brought you to write about this individual, and how did you get the authorization to write the authorized biography? Because if I'm correct, Clark died in about 1985, so either you got permission decades ago from Reverend Clark, or somebody else gave you the green light.
Yeah, well, I'll answer that second question first. You're right that Dr. Clark died in 1985, and well, I was only born in 1982, so I did not secure the rights when I was 3 years old. But we chose that title, the authorized biography, because I was working alongside his two daughters, who are alive, and who gave permission for it and gave a number of interviews and access to all of his personal papers and book collection as well. So I got interested in his writings after really searching for some something deeper in Christianity, a stronger defense of the faith, and a search for Christian intellectuals. And after reading a number of Christian intellectuals in various Christian philosophies, I was still somewhat disappointed. And when I came across Dr. Clark's work, I spent, I think, about 4 years reading his 40-plus books, and I started working on a summary of his thought, only to realize that it really had to be done in the form of a biography to give the historical context for the theological debates in which he participated.
It is kind of interesting because I've never heard of Gordon Clark, and you just mentioned that he wrote 40-some-odd books. It's like, whoa, that's a lot of books there. So how did I ever pass this guy up, and how did you find him? Were you at a, I think this guy was associated with Butler University, if I'm correct?
Yeah, that's correct. He was associated with a number of colleges and universities. I came across his writings, in the search I was doing, so I was searching quite broadly. I saw his name mentioned in one book. At the time, I was a Lutheran, so I saw this Calvinist philosopher, didn't think much of it. Later, in a search, when I was searching for that exact term, Christian philosophy, I found his Introduction to Christian Philosophy, and that really changed my perspective. So some people will come to Dr. Clark's writings after studying many other Calvinist thinkers. He's largely known, other than for writing 40-some books and for his own work in Christian philosophy, he's known for a controversy in the 1940s in what was called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, which was a small conservative offshoot of the mainline Northern Presbyterian Church. And so in the 1940s, when he sought ordination, a well-known thinker in that denomination named Cornelius Van Til and some of his associates tried to overturn Dr. Clark's ordination. And so this four-year-long Clark-Van Til controversy and the philosophical questions within that controversy impact Dr. Clark's life significantly and constitute three chapters in the, I think, 13 chapters of my book.
So what is the basis of this controversy? I sometimes get amused that theologians, especially if they're deeply trained in a seminary, oftentimes get involved in these how many angels dance on a pin kind of controversies, and these things kind of explode in many different ways. What's the nature of the controversy that's going on between Van Til and Clark?
Yeah, well, there were four theological questions, but to keep it brief, the primary one was called the incomprehensibility of God. And so the two men, both Christian philosophers, had different understandings of how man's knowledge relates to God's knowledge. And while that has been written about some in the past, I was able to go deeper into the records, into the personal papers. And also, I spent a chapter really looking at the causes of this controversy and found a number of political reasons behind the controversy itself. And to me, it seems that this type of questioning of a man seeking ordination in the church would not have happened in a typical situation, but for some of the political questions going on there in the 1940s.
Give us a little sense of those, because those sound like juicy tidbits, and I'm a political scientist.
Well, one of the ones that I noted that I don't think has made it into any of the Presbyterian history books before is that Dr. Clark was opposed to the situation at Westminster Theological Seminary, where Cornelius Van Til was teaching. Dr. Clark was opposed to the use of alcohol there at the seminary. And although at one point he might have been somewhat teetotal, he later said that he agrees with this idea of Christian liberty, and he points out Martin Luther drank beer, and he says, I'm okay with drinking, but the seminary situation has gotten out of hand, and, well, we want to try in our denomination and at the seminary, we think we can lead the fundamentalists of America and be the intellectual
basis for this movement. But we can never be the leaders of the movement if we are known as the wet denomination, if we have a problem with alcohol. If we're going to lead the Baptists, the fundamentalists, the Pentecostalists, etc., we're never going to be respected if we have an alcohol problem. Where Van Til and some of his colleagues had a Dutch background and were more open to pipe smoking and drinking alcohol and didn't want to infringe upon that idea of Christian liberty. They didn't want to put extra rules where God had not placed them, was their view.
So how did this controversy all play out? What becomes of Clark? Does somebody win this one in a WWE SmackDown and they move on, or is there a schism? What actually becomes of this, and what becomes of Clark? How does he gain his fame after this 1940 controversy?
Well, that's an interesting question, because while the controversy was fairly close in the votes in the church, Dr. Clark's ordination never was overturned, but he I think, grew tired of the issues in the church, and he ended up switching denominations to the United Presbyterian Church and then finding a job as the head of the philosophy department at Butler University, where he stayed for 28 years. And so over the following decades, he continued to write on some of these topics, and Van Til would write from the other direction. And what's really interesting is that this is still a very heated debate within Calvinist Presbyterian circles today. It's very common to see people debating Clark versus Van Til. And while the issues of the debate in the 40s surrounded Dr. Clark's views on incomprehensibility of God and other topics, today, most people want to know, what was the difference between Clark and Van Til when it comes to their apologetic methods on how they defend the faith? Because they both are early pioneers in the idea of what's called presuppositional apologetics, but they have slightly different approaches. And I think if someone can explain the difference between Clark and Van Til, they've gone fairly advanced into Calvinistic philosophy.
Yeah, that's one area that I'm not going to wade my toes in too much. Theology, I call myself a practicing Christian who needs a lot of practice. So the deep theology often gets beyond me quite a bit. One question I have for you, though, is that in the course of writing this book, did anything affect you or change the way that you view the world? Because you noted, or I noted, that when you were doing this spiritual search, you started as a Lutheran. You never said where you ended up. And so I'm wondering if the writing of the book is part of the journey, and what went on there?
Well, yeah, I, of course, now am an ordained minister in a Reformed Presbyterian church. And so I sort of made that conversion, if you want to use that word, from Lutheranism to Presbyterianism. While reading Dr. Clark's books through the period of about 2008 to 2012, and so I had largely, through his works and a few others, come to agree with the Presbyterian views on a number of topics, and decided to attend a seminary, Sangre de Cristo, which, while independent, is strongly Presbyterian in many of its views. And so I actually had basically converted and come to agree with that position prior to writing the book. And in a sense, writing Dr. Clark's biography was really a chance for me to get together my thoughts on Presbyterianism, on Dr. Clark. And so, you know, I was able to title The Presbyterian Philosopher. And one of the things we focused on in the book was Dr. Clark's adherence to the Presbyterian Confessions, the Westminster Confession of Faith, in that he was trying to develop his own Christian philosophy largely based on that historic Presbyterian confession. And while I'll admit he has some novel ideas, He tries his best usually to stay true to the historic views of the faith.
Very cool. And I have to ask where the Sangre de Cristo Seminary is. I know there's a Sangre de Cristo mountain range in New Mexico that I've hiked, but where is this one?
That's right. Yeah, the mountain range goes from northern New Mexico through southern Colorado. And I had actually been out there years before hiking Blanca Peak, which is just a really neat mountain there in southern Colorado. I had no idea about this seminary. I found out that Dr. Clark's papers were housed there, and a number of other good reasons for me to attend that seminary. And so it's a small school, about a dozen students at a time, up at 9,000 feet elevation there in the Sangre de Cristo mountain range just outside of Westcliff, Colorado. And it's really a beautiful place and fantastic people. I enjoyed my 3 years there, even if they were a bit quiet at times.
Well, quiet and being out there in nature seems to be your thing, because I want to move on to your next big project here, that you're an avid hiker, backpacker, your brother too, your twin brother is also one of these guys who's building his house in the middle of nowhere, so you love the nature thing, and you've been recently engaged in creating a very cool organization called SOLA, Appalachia Christian Retreat, I hope I pronounced that right, with somebody named Priscilla Dauma. First of all, what is this thing, and who is this Priscilla? You found somebody with the exact same name as you. That's remarkable.
Yes, Priscilla is my wife, and we met 2 years ago in Switzerland, which is part of this story connecting this together, is that I was out in Switzerland where we met at Le Brie Christian Fellowship, a place founded by the Presbyterian minister Francis Schaeffer back in the 1950s and 60s, and he became well known for his books and for this place where Christians would really come to ask him more difficult questions about the faith. And so I was out there studying this ministry because it's one of the influences on my own thought in starting my own ministry here in Appalachia. And so to give a brief summary of what we're trying to do here is that having thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail in 2013, I saw a lot of opportunity there for evangelistic work, and so we are raising support as missionaries to establish a Christian hiker hostel, to do evangelism with hikers, and then in the non-hiking season to host missionaries on furlough and to conduct a study center term in the winter of 1 or 2 months where people can come, use our library, and conduct a Christianity 101 type course and allow people to get deeper into the faith.
So you called it SOLA, and I'm guessing that there's a particular reason for that because of the Calvinist message of sola scriptura, and that, is that correct?
Yeah, I looked for names for a while. I was studying Hebrew and Greek in seminary, and I really wanted a Greek name. And I just thought Latin was terrible. You know, the Catholics, they like Latin. But eventually I settled on a Latin name, and I like it because of, while I'm fairly strongly Presbyterian in my views, there's a ecumenical flavor with the word sola, in that it was promoted first by Martin Luther and accepted by many of the Protestant groups, the ideas of sola scriptura, sola fide, sola gratia, that our authority is the scripture alone and that we are saved by God's grace alone and that this comes through faith alone. And these are really the strong principles of the Protestant Reformation. And so rather than narrowing myself into a Presbyterian corner, we chose this name, which allows us to be a Christian retreat more generally.
Now, speaking of names, and before we dive into the nature of this organization a little bit more, I mentioned in the introduction that your trail name is Bonsai. What is this trail name thing? I do a lot of hiking and backpacking. I don't have a trail name. Where can I get these, and how did you get Bonsai? That sounds like a tree or somebody jumping off a cliff into water going, Bonsai!
Well, on the Appalachian Trail, I'm not sure how long ago, decades ago now, the hikers
not wanting to give away too much personal information while they were out there, would start coming up with trail names for themselves or for each other to distinguish the five guys named John from one another. One of the famous trail names, a man who recently passed away, was Baltimore Jack, and that gives you an idea of the early trail names, I think, were often your name and maybe where you were from. But over time, I think they developed more, and very often, the dangerous thing is if you come to the Appalachian Trail to do a long hike and you do not have a trail name, you will usually receive one when you do something stupid. So you have to be careful, or your trail name becomes Mudslide or some other foible. So going into the trail in 2013, I chose my own trail name, Bonsai. Having grown up doing martial arts, I chose sort of that aggressive war cry of the Japanese that I was going to try to come at this hike with gusto. But although I did succeed, about 20% of people actually succeed on their through hike attempts. Though I did make it, it really beat me up. It was probably the most challenging thing I've endeavored.
Yeah, how long is that trail, the entire thing, and what kind of, what are we talking about in terms of up and down elevation?
Yeah, the year I hiked it was 2,186 miles. It grows slightly longer each year as they adjust some of the switchbacks to be more level and less erosion. The total elevation, I don't recall the number. It's in the hundreds of thousands of feet. And what's interesting, I learned more recently, is that the Appalachian Trail has more vertical change than any of the other trails that I'm aware of. It has more vertical change than the Pacific Crest Trail or the Continental Divide Trail. And so the average mile is about 50% more aggressive on the Appalachian Trail than, say, the Pacific Crest Trail, which makes it a particularly difficult hike.
Yeah, those are fighting words here, because I'm literally a stone's throw from the Pacific Crest Trail, and we like to think that that's a pretty tough one. But the steep hills like that, I can imagine. Never hiked it. Someday, maybe I will get out there. So the question becomes for you. You were at the Sangre de Cristo Seminary, which I love New Mexico. I love the West, the Rockies, all that kind of territory. I would have located myself out there. How'd you come to locate in Appalachia?
I had previously worked in Winston-Salem. I worked as an engineer for about 10 years before I found a call into ministry. And so I had some connections this way. And while in seminary, I was developing this idea of mission work to the Appalachian Trail, and I wasn't finding any internships. I didn't have a strong history in any particular church, and so I was struggling to find my way into pastoral ministry. And I came out this way, contacted a number of churches, only a few responded, and I came to speak at two churches about my mission, trying to seek support as a missionary. And it was interesting, because after 2 or 3 years of looking for an internship and a way to become an assistant pastor, it was at both of these churches in two successive Sundays that I was given offers to work at these churches as interns. And so I chose the one here just north of Asheville, and have been here a year and a half. I was ordained in November and promoted to an assistant pastor. And this gives me a job, but it also gives me proximity to the Appalachian Trail, so I can continue my work there on the trail. And in the biggest challenge, we're looking for a property within a mile of the trail to start this Christian hiker hostel, knowing that hikers are unwilling to come more than a mile off the trail for anything.
Mm-hmm. So you, if I'm correct, you grew up in Michigan, correct?
Yes.
And how has the adjustment been to Appalachia? I mean, are you living in a very urban area where everything just seems like, you know, urban area anywhere else? Or are you living in a more rural area that has its unique challenges, and how have you adjusted to those?
Yeah, I'm living in a fairly rural area, a town of about 5,000 people. It would be very difficult to connect here
if it were not for our church. We have a group of 100 or so at our church, and that's helped us make connections here quickly. And we also are about a half an hour away from Asheville, which is the largest city in western North Carolina. So it's a real hub for everything shopping-related and tourism and people from all over the country. So while there may be a little bit of an accent around the area we live, as you approach the city, you'll find that it's more toned down, a more neutral American accent.
And so how's this Michigan kid adjusting to the area? What kind of challenges do you face as a missionary, as a pastor out there?
Yeah, I know my wife has had probably more challenges than I have because she's from Dearborn, the Detroit area, and she's been in city more of her life than I have. I quite like the quiet, the smaller town out here. But I think that some of the challenge is just getting connected or getting trusted. It takes a long time in an area like this. I think you can live in a place for 10 years in Appalachia and you're still not from there. You might never be from here. I had the pleasure to do a number of visitations with the elderly from our church, and some of the ladies have lived here since they got married 50 or 60 years ago, and they might consider themselves from here, but I'm not sure if everyone considers them to be from here.
What about opportunities? I mean, is it a fairly religious place? Is it open to the Presbyterian church and you going out there and missionizing and things like that? Or is it, what does the faith landscape look like?
Well, it's interesting because I thought that Appalachia with the Scots-Irish immigration centuries ago would be heavily Presbyterian as the Scots-Irish were. But there's somewhat of an unanswered question in my mind. Is how and when did most of Appalachia become Baptist rather than Presbyterian? And there's some different theories on that, which I won't get into because it would be, well, speculation mostly on my part. But, there are some Presbyterian churches. There, of course, in the fundamentalist modernist controversy of the mid-20th century, many of the mainline Presbyterian churches went liberal and now have failed, have fallen, as people no longer attend those churches. And so I'm with a conservative denomination, groups of conservative churches that are slowly growing in the area. But it can be difficult in an area that's mostly Baptist. So I'd say in our area we have Baptists mostly. We have occasional conservative Presbyterian church. You know, you have your Methodists and Pentecostals. And then we certainly have the unbelievers, and I think those also in the country, that I think there are drug issues and problems with a certain element of the population. And I wanted to mention something interesting about that, because while today out in rural Appalachia you might have the heroin epidemic or meth epidemic, a century ago, there was problems with alcoholism, and our pastor here, 100 years ago, our church was planted in 1896, and the pastor back then was fighting against some of the moonshiners in this valley and got into quite a bit of trouble there, and the story is that they cut the hair off the pastor's horse as a warning to him. And what's interesting about this is that this is actually reproduced in the television show. You might remember a show in the 1990s called Christie, where actress Kelly Martin is the lead in the show, and it takes place in Tennessee, but she says she's from Asheville, North Carolina. Well, the true story in reality was that she was from here at my little Presbyterian church here, and she actually has an episode in which the pastor fights against moonshiners and has his horse's hair cut.
Wow, I had no idea about that. I don't know the television show either. We brought up this issue before when we were talking about Gordon Clark, about the issue of you're going to be a wet denomination or a dry denomination. It's a Baptist area, as you're talking about, but Reformed Presbyterians moving into the territory alongside the Baptists. Is it a wet kind of county or a dry kind of county? What kind of challenges do you have there? And how does your church position itself with a lot of the issues, either with alcohol or possibly now with different types of opioids?
Yeah. Well, I believe so. We're actually within Buncombe County, which is the same county as Asheville. So I'm sure that it's not a dry county. I've seen liquor stores, other things, and I think for the most part, the Presbyterian Church today is would favor moderation. I don't think very many Presbyterians. There's a few, but most of us would not be teetotal. We would just argue for moderation. I haven't seen any particular problems with alcoholism or with drug use among my church or some of the other churches that I've preached at in the region. That's not saying that there isn't such an issue, but it hasn't been something that's come up for me.
Okay. Well, let's talk about getting on the trail and talking about hikers and setting up a ministry for hikers, because this is going to be an interesting group of people to missionize to. I mean, we oftentimes think about, you know, going to countries that are unchurched or not Christian and preaching the gospel. Here you're dealing with a population in a relatively religious area, but they're walking through this trail. And, you know, most hikers I've come across, there's a lot of scouts that tend to be relatively religious, but there's also kind of a lot of wanderers and people that are just kind of not connected to things. Is this a spiritual population that is really thirsty for some missionizing, or is it one of these hard nuts to crack?
Well, perhaps some of both. I think there's people from all countries that walk the trail, all walks of life. I always tell a story. I was hiking with a couple men in their 60s when I was on the Appalachian Trail. It was a few months in. They had big, scraggly beards, and you would probably just think they were homeless men. And I talked to them one day and found out the one was a retired dentist, and the other was a retired general manager of a large chain of stores in North America. So I'm hiking with these millionaires who look like homeless men. And so there's really an interesting dynamic on the trail where I just think that there are a lot of people that hike the trail as a transition, whether they've just had a divorce or a death in the family. A lot of military, just coming out of the military, need a break before coming into society. And they really are in a seeking pattern, whether they would confess that or not. And, of course, as a Christian pastor, I believe that the end to their search is faith in Jesus Christ, and that only belief in him and the salvation promised by Christ and the hope that we have in him, I believe that's the only hope that we have, and so that they will continue to search and to find lesser things until they find the greatest thing of all, which is the God of creation.
That's a fascinating observation, because as somebody who has backpacked and done a lot of hiking and camping, going on the trail really takes you out of your normal everyday element. It makes you rethink everything. You're out there in nature. You start to understand how small you are, how fragile in many ways you are. It's like, you know, do we have enough food? And what happens if the backpack falls down the cliff? And you know, what if there's a storm coming on? So you're in a very vulnerable position. You feel small. You feel fragile. Does that become this kind of opportunity to reach out to people and to missionize to them?
Yeah, I want to be a little bit careful, because I don't want it to be that. I think some non-believers I've seen feel like I might be preying on people or what the case might be. But we want to be clear. We have Christian in our mission name, so anyone who does come stay at our place knows that we are Christians. We'll provide opportunities and evenings to have hymn sings or Bible readings, and we'll provide small Gideon's New Testaments that people can take with them. But I'm there just as just to preach the word and to plant a seed. I fully admit that it's only by God's power that conversion can happen. And so I rely on him for those things. And so it's not my job to pressure someone into conversion, but we definitely want to be there to answer questions. As I mentioned with Francis Schaeffer and his ministry, his was really a mission to the intellectuals in Europe in the 1960s and 70s. And although I don't certainly have all the answers, I have been studying the Christian faith and other philosophies for a number of years, and have perhaps some ability to point people to the answers in the scriptures, which I believe is our sole source of truth in this life. And so that's where I see my mission. I want to continue to work in the church, but I also don't want to be solely just with the church. I want to be able to get out there with this mission. And I think that, you know, on Appalachian Trail season, if we're able to have 10 or 15 people every night coming through for 4 months, that there'll be a lot of good opportunities to have conversations with people and to help them out and to point them to Christ. So we're definitely looking forward to that.
Walk me through one of these typical encounters, because again, having backpacked, you're out on the trail, you're with a group of people, maybe, you know, 8-9 people or so in your group. You occasionally see people, but not all the time. It's not people coming through. You're with the small people. People kind of wander by. You wave to them. You say, hey, how you doing? Any hazards up the trail or something like that? How do you get people connected to your mission? How do you open the conversation? Do you say, hey, come on over, we're having some s'mores on the campfire tonight, and here's Jesus? Or is it just kind of organically happen? Sometimes it doesn't happen, sometimes it does. Walk us through a typical encounter.
Yeah, so the primary way in which hikers find hiker hostels and services along the trail is the Appalachian Trail guidebook. And so once we have acquired property, we will be trying to get into that guidebook to offer ourselves there. And then definitely word of mouth will be a primary way as people go up and down the trail. This past year, we, as a promotion to our donors and supporters, we printed off bandanas and sent them to each person. And that's something I want to continue with, is promotional bandanas that people can take from our place and hike down the trail, promoting us as they go. So right now we've been raising financial support, and I think we're almost there as far as able to purchase a property. We're just waiting for the right situation to come up. So in the meanwhile, we're doing what we can with evangelism to the trail, which is occasionally going up there. And another Appalachian Trail tradition is called trail magic. And so we go up to the trail and bring drinks and a cooler on ice, bring food, and talk to the hikers. We did this a couple weeks ago, had about 40 hikers come through on one day, and were able to really make a lot of people happy. And then we have the Gideon's Testaments there as well. We will, if the situation's right, we'll ask people if we can be praying for them or just how their hike is going, and then offer the testaments as well. And we've had some people take those as they go. So far in our trail magic experiences, we haven't had any sort of more aggressive encounters, but I expect that will happen over time.
How do you know somebody is open to it? You just mentioned that. You know, here's some Kool-Aid. You know, how's the hike going? And, you know, do you got any blisters we can take care of or anything like that? We got some medical supplies. But then how do you know that there's an opening?
Yeah, I don't think you can. I mean, we always make them available. I try to muster up the courage to talk to as many people as possible. But yeah, I think I'm hoping that in our ministry, that people will be aware that we're Christians by our title, by the fact that I'm a minister, if they find that out, or by reputation, and perhaps some people will more organically come and ask us questions as well. So that would be a preferred thing. I don't like to have too confrontational of conversations, though
there are times when they're necessary. I'm a little bit more of a relational approach with people, and that's why with those who are interested in our ministry, the plan is to invite people back in the non-hiking season to have those longer study terms where people will stay at the facility longer, get involved cooking, cleaning, working outside, and then taking courses from us or studying in the library for the other half of the day. And so I think there'll be a lot of opportunities there, and we'll pray that the Lord has an effect there with our ministry.
So in terms of setting up this hostel, and kind of give us an idea of what a hiking hostel looks like, because I haven't encountered any of these. And is it, you got a building, like maybe a couple A-frames where people can just kind of come and take a break? I don't have to pitch my tent tonight. I can just lay in a cot underneath a wood frame building or something like that. And what goes on in a typical hostel, and what plans do you have for your hostel?
Yeah, well, hostels are much more common in other countries, Europe, elsewhere, but there probably are, there's somewhere between 50 and 100 of them on the Appalachian Trail. It's quite a common thing. They usually go about $25 a night to stay, and you get a bunk. They vary quite a bit. Some places are very rustic. Some have more services. And so I'm trying to take some of the better ideas from the places that I've stayed at. We would like to provide a dinner and a breakfast, both for a reasonable price. We'd also like to have a gear shop for hiking gear to be sold, and for food, for dry goods, resupply for hiking on the trail. So I really would like it to be one of the top hostels on the trail. I'd really like it to be more than just a simple place to stop, but maybe something that someone would want to stay at for multiple days.
Well, that is kind of cool. And you mentioned in terms of opening the conversation that at times you were kind of nervous about doing this. Has it become easier over time to talk to people on the trail about this? Because, you know, hikers are kind of a unusual and mixed bunch of folks. So, how's that been changing for you?
Well, I'd have to admit that it probably hasn't become easier. And, right now, not having yet got our property, I've mentioned that sometimes, that's the biggest challenge right now in establishing this mission. So our work has been somewhat limited until we're able to get up there more permanently. And I'm hoping over time that I'll be able to sort of hone my approach or conversation skills and be less nervous about evangelistic work.
Yeah, it's always interesting to talk to folks kind of at the ground level on this too, because you are just starting this up and you're trying to raise the funds for getting the building, the land purchased, and everything up and running. By the way, how's that going? How close are you to goal?
Well, it's going fairly well. I mean, we have, I think, about $36,000 raised and some of our own money possibly to put in towards the venture. We're fortunate that in Appalachia, it's a lower cost region. But we're definitely looking for more supporters in the long term. We've been speaking at churches throughout the area. We've, I think, spoken at 17 churches in the last year and a half, have some more coming up on the radar. But the Lord has allowed us, I think, this time to plan things a little more slowly, get a business license, a post office box, just all the little bits and pieces towards building this up. But yeah, once we have a physical property, I think that will help interest people in the project more. They can see the place, come out there for themselves. We have some church groups and individuals who would like to come up and do service projects and help us get this up and running. So I might mention a little plug. The website is discoversola.com, so people can read more about our mission there, see how to donate, or invite me to come speak at their church, or whatever connection that they might find.
Yeah, we'll link to that at our website, and also bring it forth on our Facebook and Twitter feeds as well. As I was mentioning, it's really interesting to see somebody at the ground floor starting all of this stuff up, because oftentimes when you build a big mega church, and you talk to somebody 10, 15, 20 years in the future and they look back, oh yeah, those times were, you know, very easy for us, or, you know, very difficult, or, you know, the mythology builds over time. So it's kind of fun looking at what you're doing here at the ground level, and we'll have to kind of keep an eye on this and see how you progress along the way. One question I want to finish up with here is that you are an interesting person in that you're a nexus between practitioner and a scholar, somebody who says, I'm just going to go write a book on this Gordon Clark guy. Not many people do that. So interesting life you've led already. I would guess you said born in 1982, so you're in your mid-30s now. What things have you learned over the years? And in kind of to frame this question, if you could travel back in time, what would you go back and tell 18-year-old Doug?
Yeah, I know you sent the questions ahead of time, and I saw that one. I wasn't really sure how to answer it. I was thinking, well, I don't want to ruin any of the adventure for him. And I was thinking about Back to the Future. Maybe I'd tell him some of the sports scores so he could win a bunch of money, or tell him to invent Facebook, make a bunch of money, and then befriend Tony Gill.
There you go.
But yeah, I wasn't really sure how to answer that question. I think the Lord has his plan laid out the way it is, and so I'm okay with where he has brought me through life. I don't have many major regrets. I think I have usually done fairly well with the knowledge I've had at any point.
Very cool. And what are the plans for the future other than building this hostel? Where do you see your life in 10 or 15 years from now and having that future person come back and talk to you?
Well, right now we are expecting our first child due in October, so that's very exciting. And then continuing to work on this mission. I would really like to do, if we can make this successful, I would like to do this type of missionary work for the long term. But seeing that it is a little bit unorthodox, I do think that there'll be opportunities in the future for me to work in more full-time pastoral ministry. But my ideal is a situation where it's sort of bivocational, still involved in the church as an assistant minister, but working also as an evangelist on the Appalachian Trail or in another location. So it's hard. We'll have to see where the Lord guides us. You can always say, I want this or that in life, but I've always found that the reality is that there's only certain options out there. The college has to accept your application. The woman has to agree to your proposal, or the job has to hire you. You can think all you want about going to Harvard and working for NASA and marrying a supermodel, but those aren't the the realities. Mm-hmm.
Well, that'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to see if this comes to fruition with the building and everything, and maybe you can bring a franchise out here on the Pacific Crest Trail or someplace in the Rockies too, because it sounds like a very fascinating idea, a great way to reach out to people in a kind of a moment out there in nature where you can see all God's glory, which is one of the ways that I tend to connect with my own faith in that. My guest today has been Douglas Dauma. Doug, or Bonsai, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.